Okay, friends, Greg Kokel here, and of course, welcome to the show. Glad you're part of what we do at Stand to Reason on a regular basis, and I'm going to try to solve a problem for you this hour. Actually, I'm not going to do this problem solving. My guest is going to do that, and it's a big problem. It's a problem that I face on a regular basis, and one that I am constantly hanging my head shamefully regarding. In fact, I was asked on a Facebook Live last week, how do I guide my own children in their spiritual growth? And I went, oh, please don't ask me that question, because this is where I feel completely inadequate. Surprisingly, given what I do for a living, I think a lot of people would be surprised. But look, most of the people that I talk to, and there are a lot of them, want to hear what I have to say. When it comes to family members, especially your children, especially if they're like teenagers and they kind of have a will and a mind of their own much more aggressively than when they're younger, well, that's a different matter. You know, they don't always want to listen to dad. People say, that was the greatest talk I ever heard. I was hanging on every word. I said, look, I wish my kids would say that, but they don't. They have a totally different attitude. And that's why I need some help. And I suspect you do as well. And my guest for this hour is the author of actually three books now that are meant to help us beleaguered parents to guide the spiritual lives of our children in a way that's productive, lays a good foundation, and it actually prepares them for the challenges that they're going to face when they're out of our care. Now, her first book was Keeping Your Kids on God's Side, 40 Conversations to Help Them Build Lasting Faith. That came out in 2016, and it was actually a finalist in the new author category with the Evangelical Christian Publishers Association. Nicely done. Second one, Talking to Your Kids About God, 30 Conversations Every Parent Must Have. Ooh, ouch. Okay, we'll talk about that in a minute. And now just released, Talking to Your Kids About Jesus, another 30 conversations every Christian parent must have. Just came out. Of course, I'm talking about writer, speaker, and host of the blog, Christian Mom Thoughts. Her name is Natasha Crane. And Natasha, you have been keeping busy. My goodness.
Yes, I have been keeping busy. If you add up all those numbers of conversations you just talked about, I think that's 100 conversations across all the books.
That we must have. Well, it's a little bit daunting, but, you know, just my experience with you in the past, of course, we've known each other for a while, and we just, last year, we went to Israel together with a group, and your husband and my wife, and we all were there, and that was really great spending time together. And I just really admire your ability to do what you do so well. And that is not only to guide your own children, but to take our hand, take us by the hand as parents and guide us as well. But I want to, by way of introduction or getting rolling here, I want to say something about the wonderful opening line of your second book, which was Talking to Your Kids About God. In my opinion, this is right up there with Dickens's It Was the Best of Times and It Was the Worst of Times. Here's how she starts. My backyard is where plants go to die. Well, that's great. I wanted to keep reading, obviously, or what comes next. And your first book is pretty good, too. It starts, I remember the exact day I realized I had no idea what I was doing as a parent. I mean, what parent can't identify with that? But your most recent book, and that's the topic of our discussion today, Natasha, is Talking with Your Kids About Jesus. So you're zeroing in here. And you make a comment as you start your book, and I'll read it, and I want you to respond to it, that goes to what we are just kind of chuckling about, 30 plus 30 plus 40 is 100 conversations you must have, and how overwhelming this would feel to a lot of parents when they see that. And you address that immediately in your book, and your opening line of this book is, I was scrolling through Facebook recently when I saw an article that stopped me in my tracks, 5 things people with tiny homes don't do. And that article got you thinking about the burden parents have of taking the responsibility for their children's spiritual education. So why don't we use that as a springboard and talk a little bit about that article and how it tutored you a bit in how to address these broader issues of training our children in the way they should go.
Right. So I, as I explained in the introduction of the book, I am horrible at keeping my house picked up. It's just something that I have always struggled with. We always have stuff all over the place. There are homework papers on the floor. We have pencils on seat cushions. There's just always stuff around. But I have always seen when I go to other people's houses that it doesn't look like that. And so I've always had the sense that there is something that other people know that I don't know. So when I saw that article about things that tidy people don't do, I thought, okay, I need to read this one immediately. And one of the things that just stuck out to me so much as soon as I read it was that it said tidy people don't look like don't act like slobs all day and then suddenly pick everything up in one fell swoop. Instead, they take little tiny pieces of their day and they clean up as they go. So it's what they call low grade tidying. And I just thought that that was such a great analogy for, first of all, it was a good advice for what we do for cleaning our houses to just go a little bit as we go, but also for how we raise our kids and having these kinds of faith conversations. The purpose of my books is not to give parents a giant laundry pile of stuff to put in their living room and say, hey, this is all the stuff you have to do. You're going to do this giant clean out of your kids' spiritual lives. You know, you have to go on a retreat somewhere and buckle down and have all these conversations.
And have 100 conversations.
Yes, 100 conversations. That sounds so overwhelming. That's not what we want. Instead, we want to see this as an ongoing way of life, as a tidying of our kids' understanding of Jesus as we go about our walk. And, you know, just like Deuteronomy 6 says, when we sit down and when we walk along the road and lie down and get up, we constantly want this to be part of our lives. And it's not doing the giant clean out. It's really just an ongoing way of life. Mm-hmm. So I love the low grade tidying analogy for that.
Yeah, it was very encouraging to me to see that. And I made a reference to this earlier as we started the show that I have my own sense of guilt in not being better at this than I would like to be. And I read one line in your introduction that really described me, at least in part, and I think describes a lot of Christian parents out there. You wrote, "We know we should have more faith conversations than we do. And the ones we do have don't go as we'd like." And then you add, "And discouragement sets in when we don't feel equipped to answer the questions our kids raise." Now, that last one doesn't apply to me because this is what I do for a living. I know the answers. However, I don't have the conversations I'd like to have with my kids. And when I try to do it, I promise you, Natasha, I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but when I've sat my family down to have a spiritual time, every demon in the zip code comes to my house and sits on the couch and on the mantle and on the lampshades and creates absolute chaos. I mean, have you ever noticed anything like that?
Oh, no, never. Yes, of course. Of course. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like you said, just because you do this stuff for a living doesn't necessarily mean that everything's working perfectly when you have the conversations with your kids. Just because I write books about having conversations with your kids doesn't mean they always go perfectly. And mm-hmm. I think that just setting those expectations is so important for parents to understand, because I think if we expect that when we sit down that our kids are going to be perfect little angels and hang on every word that we have, we will be sorely disappointed every time, because mm-hmm. that happens in precious few families. Mm-hmm. And, you know, expectations are the source of all disappointment. I've always loved that quote because I think that is how we get so disappointed. So I think parents have to come into this whole project of raising kids in the faith with the understanding it's not always going to be easy, but just because it doesn't seem to be working or working the way that we think it should, doesn't mean we shouldn't be doing it or mm-hmm. that we should give up. We might have to fine tune our methodology a bit. We might have to think more about strategically how do we reach our kids in certain ways, but it doesn't mean we give up just because it gets difficult. But yes, every single parent encounters this.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is one of the reasons I like your books, all three of them, because what they do is they provide a plan for people like me or for other parents to kind of make these things happen in a reasonable fashion. And they're all, as you pointed out, how did you put it about tidying up,
The low-grade tidying.
Right. That's it. The low-grade tidying that we can accomplish little here, a little bit there, that over time adds up. And you show us precisely in your book how to do the kind of so-called low-grade tidying with the spiritual instruction of our kids, especially with regards to apologetics, but you understand, and it's clear in your books, that you can't defend the faith unless you know what the faith is. And so a whole bunch of what you do is to lay a foundation of what the biblical teaching is on issues and then deal with some of the objections to that. So you mentioned in your books that these are must-have conversations. Why are these conversations must-haves?
Well, I think the theme of all my books is that there are certain conversations that we as parents need to have with our kids today, specifically given the challenges that they're going to encounter in this world the way that it is. So I always give parents the analogy of climbing Mount Everest. You know, if you're going to send your kids to climb a mountain, you're not going to just say, okay, we'll do some jumping jacks and then you'll head out there and you'll climb the mountain just fine. You would know that you're going to have to do some very specific things in order to train them for the challenges that they'll encounter. And mm-hmm. So in the same way, we need to prepare our kids for what they're going to encounter spiritually in today's world. These are the conversations that in my experience over the last several years in learning about apologetics, engaging with skeptics myself through my blog and through my writing and through my speaking, these are the conversations that kids most need to understand given what they'll encounter. And so that's why I say they're must-have conversations. Mm-hmm. They're the things that kids will run up against today. And they're the things that, according to research, also are challenging kids. And I think that's important for a lot of parents to hear because sometimes they think, you know, I never really dealt with this myself, or I didn't have to learn all these things and how to respond to these questions. I grew up, I was a Christian, and that was it. Why do I need to worry about it? But we actually have a lot of research around, of course, the fact that kids are walking away, but not just that, why they're walking away. And we can mm-hmm. see the nature of the challenges that are really pushing kids away from the faith. And so these are the questions that will help prepare them for that.
One of the nice things about being able to address the questions the way you do with your children and teaching us to do that, it shows our kid that we're not afraid of the questions. We're not running from the questions. We're not saying don't ask those questions, just have faith, or those kind of bromides that really have caused more problems for us than helped in the past. But that's been kind of the standard approach that a lot of Christian parents have taken in the past.
Yeah, I think that a lot of parents are afraid that they're going to look bad if they don't know an answer to a question. So it's a lot easier to just tell their kids, hey, you know, that we're just Christians, we have faith, without realizing that biblical faith is putting your trust in what you have good reason to believe is true.
Right.
So
right.
A lot of what I try to do when I speak and write is to help parents understand that's what faith is, that's what we're called to have. We're not called to just kind of blindly jump off a cliff and take our kids with us. So I think that in terms of credibility, you have a lot more credibility as a parent when you tell your kids, hey, we have nothing to fear. Truth has nothing to fear. If Christianity is true, then we should be able to pursue all of these questions. And in this house, that's the environment that we want to build. I might not mm-hmm. always know the answer to something, but if I don't, we'll figure it out. And I'll help show you how we would pursue that answer. So I think the credibility is more on the line when you try to tell your kids, don't ask the questions, or we just need to have faith, than it is if you don't know the answer, but welcome the mm-hmm. question.
Now, I'm going to ask you a question about your book you may not know the answer to, and I'll tell you why.
Uh-oh. Okay.
Warning you in advance.
Lay it on me.
It's because some people will say, well, in your book, you give 3 points about this, and it's very general. And I'm thinking, what the heck are they talking about? I wrote the book, but I can't remember the 3 points. So I'm going to talk about 3 points that you mentioned. And if you can't recall them, I completely understand. But here's the question. Yeah, she's got the book right there.
Yeah, let me grab my book. Okay, quick. What page are we going to?
So what I wrote down here in my prep, as I said, your book is a guide to those long-term, low-grade spiritual tidying conversations. We've already talked about that. But in your book, you identify 3 specific ways that you help parents accomplish those kinds of conversations, just general things. Tell us about them.
Yeah, well, now that I have the book in front of me, no problem, Greg. Let me answer that so
That's
quickly
why I
here.
Warned you in advance.
I love it. Well, the first thing is that it will help you focus on what most needs tidying in your kids' understanding of Jesus, as I was saying, given the challenges of today's world. So we can't clean everything, right? You know, I was having my kids clean the house today, and I was just thinking, you know, there's no way that we can clean absolutely everything. So we need some kind of focus on what takes the highest priority. And so that's the first thing, is really to just get those questions in front of parents so that they have an understanding.
Right. And this book is about questions regarding Jesus, as opposed
exactly.
to the prior books about questions about God or just keeping your kids on God's side, more general things. All really good. But here's the focus on Christ. Go ahead. Sorry.
Exactly. So the very first book was just kind of an apologetics 101 for parents, covering all the different areas. The last one honed in specifically on God questions, and then this one on the Jesus questions. So these are the questions that most need tidying about Jesus questions. And then once you know what you need to focus on, the next thing is that you have to kind of understand, what are the essential points that my kids need to get about this? We can go super deep on all of these questions when you start asking, you know, how do we know that Jesus performed miracles, or, you know, what did Jesus' death on the cross accomplish? Those are a couple of chapters from the book. You could go a long way in those. But the book really tries to simplify it down to just 5 or 6 pages each for the chapter, so that parents kind of get the key points. And then there are a lot of different recommendations for reading in the end notes if you want to go deeper than that. And then finally,
in other words, let me jump in for a second, because I want to emphasize that Natasha has done the work for you. You don't have to go to all the books and try to put together a basic outline. This is kind of meant to be a turnkey enterprise. We'll talk more about the details of that in a moment, but I think it's great. And it's not only for kids. What you've done is simplified a whole host of issues that represent challenges from the outside that a lot of adults need to get squared away on as well. Sorry. So the third point.
Well, that's actually something I hear a lot from parents, especially when I do speaking engagements. They come and afterwards and they say, you know, I came here for my kids because I needed to know what to tell my kids, but I'm realizing I don't know all this stuff. I need it. So, yes, the book is definitely framed around parenting, but overwhelmingly, I think most parents will take a lot away from the book itself that maybe they didn't know before. And the third point, the final point, is that it will give you a vision for how to do the tidying. So it gives you a focus for what to tidy. It gives you the essential points for what your kids need to understand. And then it has a step-by-step conversation guide at the end of every chapter to help you think about, okay, now I understand these 5-6 pages on this subject. How do I get that out of my head and into conversation with my kids? And I had the conversation guides in the last book as well, but I did this after feedback on my first book, Keeping Your Kids on God's Side, that so many parents said, this is great information. I love it. I'm starting to get it, but I'm still having trouble like figuring out how do I start the conversations. And so that's why I started for these two books, to put these guides in. And it just starts with a really easy conversational opener that even a 5-6-year-old could understand and answer. And then it gets more deep, it gets deeper and deeper from there.
My guest is Natasha Crane. She's the author first of Talking to Your Kids About God, 30 Conversations Every Christian Parent Must Have. Oh, wait a minute. The first one was Keeping Your Kids on God's Side. That's 40 conversations. Then Talking to Your Kids About God, that's 30 conversations. And now Talking to Your Kids About Jesus, another 30 conversations. And as we'll discover in a moment, these are easy to do in a certain sense. They are turnkey. You don't have to invent anything. It's kind of point and click, just very easy for parents to get involved with laying a foundation for their kids' spiritual convictions and defending them too. Let's go to break. More when we get back with Natasha Crane.
Some people treat Christianity like it's a build-your-own Sunday shop. They include the bits they like and exclude the bits they don't. The problem is, truth is not ice cream. You can't build your own biblical reality like you build your own ice cream sundae. You can't pick and choose the parts you prefer. Truth doesn't work like that. Truth is what matches up with reality. Sadly, there are some who are creating a version of Christianity that fits their own subjective desires rather than sound doctrine. At this year's STR Reality Conferences, you will get the tools to identify counterfeit versions of Christianity so you can guard against them. We want to show you that biblical reality isn't something we shape. Rather, it's something that shapes us. So join us at one of this year's reality conferences, and let's discover why truth is not ice cream.
You can take Stand to Reason with you through our mobile apps, available for free from the App Store or the Google Play Store. The Quick Reference app gives you short, easily accessible courses on our most popular topics like tactics, homosexuality in the Bible, morality, the story of reality, and many more. The Stand to Reason app has all our latest content available at your fingertips. You can listen to our podcasts, check the blog, and access timely and practical resources. They're free, so download the apps today on the App Store or the Google Play Store and start carrying Stand to Reason with you everywhere you go. If you enjoy our apps, you can help other people find them by rating them on the App Store or the Google Play Store.
Thank you. All right, friends, Greg Kochel back at you here. I'm looking for the nod from Eric, and he's just bebopping to the music. Was that a nod? Was that like, okay, Kochel, your turn, or what? But I do like the bumper music. Thank you. Greg Kochel here, Stand to Reason. My guest, Natasha Crane, currently author of the current book, just came out, a couple weeks ago, Natasha?
3 weeks ago, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Talking to Your Kids About Jesus, 30 Conversations Every Christian Parent Must Have, and that's her third book of the same kind. You mentioned in your book that what this book won't do, you talk about what it does do, and we've discussed that, it gives you a way of doing kind of low-grade spiritual tidying with your kids, a little here, a little there, without having to take on the whole enterprise all at once, which would be daunting. But what the book doesn't do is create the actual habit of tidying, and that's up to the parent. Do you have any suggestions how parents can actually make the time or the space to get this done?
Yeah, and I think it's funny to even point that out in a book because, of course, a book cannot create a habit. But I know, Greg, that you understand as an author that people will always come back and say, no, but the book didn't do this or it didn't do that. And so that was kind of the caveat. Hey, I can't actually force you into the right habits here. You're going to have to do that part, but I'm going to give you the tools that you need. So in terms of habit building, I think of it in two parts. I think of it as creating moments and using moments. And so here's what I mean by that. Using moments is what parents often hear of as teachable moments. There are things in everyday life that come up where we just have these natural opportunities to throw something in because it's tied to something that our kids bring up, or it's tied to something that they just saw on TV or we watched a movie together. Those things are beautiful because they're so relevant. They happen at a given time in their lives, and it's not so forced. It's not, hey, we're going to sit down and do this right now. So that's wonderful. And that is a huge part of how I hope that my books will help parents, because you cannot use a teachable moment unless you can first identify it. And you're going to miss a lot of teachable moments if you're not aware of all these kinds of issues. So if you're not aware of the questions skeptics are asking, you're not aware of the challenges kids are facing and what's making kids walk away, you're not going to even think to have the conversations when those opportunities arise. So a lot of times when parents say, well, how do I find the time? My first suggestion is always get equipped yourself with an understanding of these things, because your worldview radar will go up and you will start to see these things come about all the time. Mm-hmm. But that said, it's never going to be enough for us to rely on teachable moments. There are some things we have to talk about with our kids that just don't naturally arise from these kinds of things in our daily lives. For example, you might never come across the perfect teachable moment for talking with your kids about slavery in the Bible and whether or not the Bible supports that, as skeptics so often claim. But that doesn't mean it's not something that we should talk about with them. Mm-hmm. So there are things that we have to do to create moments, whether that's I'm going to identify this question from this book and we're going to bring it up at dinner time and say, hey, this is something we want to talk about. Or maybe it's a weekly study that you do together as a family. Our family is doing weekly Bible studies. We keep it exactly at 30 minutes every weekend when we get together, because I have found that when the kids know exactly how long something's going to last, you're going to keep their attention longer. Otherwise, they're constantly wondering, how much longer does this go on?
Oh,
you know,
yeah,
how much,
right.
How long do I have to sit here? And this is one of the best things we have done, honestly, because I know exactly what to expect.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are some of the things you can do to create those moments, whether you're bringing something to the dinner table or you're bringing something, an article that you saw that day and saying, hey, I just read this in this article. What do you guys think about that? But those are things that are on the parent to bring to the kids. And mm-hmm. So those are the moments that we have to create. And I think that whether you're using moments or creating moments, the key to that is the parent's knowledge and the parent's understanding of what their kids need to know.
You know, something that occurred to me, Natasha, is the challenge of I'm trying to think of the best way to characterize this. I'm just going to call it ordinary Christianity. And what I mean by that, it's not a pejorative label. It's the Christianity kids grew up with and they presume is true. And everybody who's a Christian believe it's true. And there's no question about whether or not it's true. But they don't have a clear sense of even what it entails or what it means. So the Bible's the Word of God. Of course it is. All we have to do is quote it, and there we go. And if we're quoting it accurately in context, rock and roll from there. But then a lot of people, it turns out, don't believe that. Or they say, what does it mean to be a Christian? And, well, believe in Jesus. Well, what does that mean? And so built into our, what did I call it, ordinary Christianity are all kinds of concepts that are actually kind of vague for the rank and file. And I think in all of your books, especially in this one on Jesus, though, as pertaining to Jesus, you go into more depth about what do these concepts, what are these phrases that we toss around, what do they mean? What is their substance? Why is it important to understand more of the particulars? Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think that is so important to really get into the nuts and bolts of what something actually means that we say all the time. And one that jumps out to me from the book, and I do talk about this a lot in the book throughout all the chapters, but, you know, hearing that Jesus died for my sins, for example, I heard that like a slogan when I was a kid. You know, I just over and over, Jesus died for my sins. Great, I know, I'm forgiven, I'm saved, and someday I'm going to go to heaven when I die, and I'm going to do my best to, you know, live up to God's standards until that day. You know, it's kind of this basic understanding, but what exactly does that mean that Jesus died for my sins? Why did he have to die for my sins? And what about people who would say that that's, you know, some kind of cosmic child abuse? All these challenges that you hear about today, they challenge those very fundamental things that we haven't even thought through a lot of times, mm-hmm. Christians. Mm-hmm. And so that's why the last section of my book is called The Difference Jesus Makes. And so after kind of going through sections on the identity of Jesus, teachings of Jesus, death of Jesus, resurrection of Jesus, I get to, okay, but what's the difference? If all this is true, how do we apply it and what difference does it make for us? And some of those questions in that section, as I acknowledge in the book, sound so basic. The first one is, what is a Christian? Like you said, that sounds so basic, right? But if you ask 20 different people, you're going to get 20 different answers, even who would identify themselves as Christians. And so we have to help our kids get deeper than just that ordinary Christian mm-hmm. understanding, as you're calling it, because otherwise they're just going to get squashed by hearing mm-hmm. the different definitions. And then they can become fooled by things that seem like the real thing, but aren't the real thing. And I think that's the danger when we don't go deeper.
Right. We've talked about this next question before with your prior books, but it's good to bring people up to date who are not familiar with them. The book is a third in a series. We talked about that. And your books kind of follow a certain pattern pedagogically. In other words, how you use the material to move through these spiritual tidying conversations. Can you tell us a little bit about the step-by-step process that is laid out in any given conversation that you describe there in your book? And there's probably four or five or six per section, and we'll get to the sections momentarily. But tell us how it's laid out.
So with each chapter, I try to bring in something, you know, a parenting anecdote to start it off, just so that parents understand how these things might come up in everyday life. Or maybe it's just an analogy, something that you can more easily remember about that particular conversation. But almost always, I'd say the chapters start with investigating, why does it matter? And what do we even mean by this? And so it kind of goes back to that last question that you were asking about, what do we mean by these different things? But it's so important to me that parents understand in each of those chapters why the conversation does matter. First of all, what are skeptics saying? So in every single one, I'll acknowledge, you know, these are the kinds of things that skeptics are claiming about this subject. And here's why it matters in terms of your kid's spiritual development and drawing those connections for the parents so that they can say, okay, I need to care about what I'm going to read in the next four pages. That's always what's on my mind. How do I make a parent understand they need to care about what's here? And then from there, going into the key points that need to be made with our kids about that subject, with a lot of jumping off points into the end notes, like I was saying later. And then with every chapter, I have key points, which is kind of funny because the chapters are very short, but then you get to a page of key points. And I remember one of my editors, when she first got the book, she wasn't familiar with my work before. And she said, do we really need key points with every chapter? That is exactly what I have heard parents say they love so much about the book, because All this material is stuff I've summarized from all these different places into these short, packed chapters. But then it's really easy to forget, like, okay, what were the key takeaways if you want to quickly go back later? So I always come back to those key points, and then you have the conversation.
Right. I call that throwing the ball so people can catch it. And you do that so well in the way you organize your book. And then you have some conversation guidelines, right? After the key points. Go ahead.
Right. And then that's where the conversation guide is, that has the step-by-step questions, starting with the easiest one and then working your way up into what I call apply the conversation. And that actually takes a lot of time when writing these books, is to find a quote from a skeptic that challenges everything that you just learned in that chapter. And so it's a real life quote that kids who are tweens and teens who are old enough to kind of process this more deeply can practice responding to. So it's there so that parents can walk through this conversation, go through these questions, and then say, okay, now that you have learned this, here's what somebody might say to you. And then they have this quote, and then it's a chance to practice responding. Yeah.
So do you find sometimes in these conversations with kids that, I know there must be times where you just kind of go through it, the kids are not into it, but do you find sometimes they just really take off on it and it's really interesting and it kind of gains a life of their own, where the kids get into it a lot? Or is it kind of a mixed bag? What's your experience with that?
Yeah, I think it totally depends on the child and where they are and what they're interested in talking about. I think that there are always going to be some topics that are less interesting to kids than others. But if your child in particular is questioning, you know, how do we know Jesus is God? Then chapter 3 on that question is going to be very interesting to them. Whereas somebody else, another kid who accepts that, yes, I believe Jesus is God, but, you know, does he really teach all this, you know, stuff that I'm hearing? They're going to be more interested in section 2 of the book, which is on the teachings of Jesus. And
so
I think it really depends on where the child is. And although I would love for a parent to sit down and work through the whole book step by step, because I've laid it out very methodically, the reality is that in some cases, it will just be more relevant to a kid to jump in with wherever they currently are in terms of needing that understanding. You know, if they're questioning the resurrection, go to the resurrection section, or if they're questioning the death of Jesus, go there.
Right.
But low-grade tidying, right? Over time, you come back to all these different chapters and keep tying it together for your kids.
Yeah, it's like, to me, it's kind of like a recipe book, like, okay, what's for dinner tonight? I don't know. What are you hungry for? And you can kind of go through whatever pages in here. We're going to take this part or another part, whatever. I think one of the biggest challenges that maybe parents have in getting these things going, and this I'm speaking a bit autobiographically now, has to do with what if you don't have like willing participants, and for example, what if you're starting late in this process, and the children aren't, you know, like 4 and 5 year olds that you can hold down tied to the couch, but they're teenagers, you know, kind of them. Just joking, they're friends, but or what if the said teenagers are not interested in having these kinds of discussions? Or what if one or more of your children or all of your children don't share your own spiritual convictions yet? So we still have a responsibility to teach unwilling subjects important things, not just spiritually, but all kinds of things, you know, how to make your bed, how to do dishes, how to clean up your room, and all the things that prepare them for life. They're usually not too excited about that. So what have you found ways that will help with this particular speed bump that parents might be running into?
Well, we talked a little bit about expectations earlier, and this is one of the most important things for me personally that I have learned in my own family, is to expect that your kids' spiritual lives and their interest levels will go up and down, that they will fluctuate, just, you know, as adults, we experience this too. And just because your child might be in a slump or maybe they're not interested at that given time doesn't mean that that's when we just give up. That's when I think especially that's the time limit that I talked about when we get together as a family.
Putting
some boundaries around it and saying, hey, as a family, this is what we do because we're the parents and these are our convictions. We're going to get together and we're going to have this time, but this is how much time you can expect. And here's what we're going to do. And I found that even though we've gone through periods where, you know, I have 3 kids, I have 11-year-old twins and a 9-year-old. And there have been periods where not one of them wants to hear what we have to say. I mean, they're hitting each other. They're standing on their heads. They're yelling, screaming. I mean, it can be all over the place.
That's the demons. That's where the demons have come. come in to incite revolution.
That's right. But it takes, I think it takes perseverance of just mentally to think, okay, I'm not going to let this take me away from the fact that we're going to keep doing it. And over time, we've ended up getting back into great conversations. And so number one, that has been a huge learning thing for me because I'm more of a linear person. I think like I'm going to continue to see all these results just build upon each other and it's going to be this great tower of learning, but it just doesn't always look like that. It's a lot more jagged.
Let me toss a thought in here. I know you have more to say on this, but as I'm looking back at my own circumstances, my trying to get something going has been so difficult. Okay, we're all going to sit down. We're going to read through Pilgrim's Progress. You read a portion. I'll read a portion. I'll read a portion. What's being referred to here? What biblical thing is being made reference to? Blah, blah, blah. And then, but it's so hard to get going. And I got to do this. I got to do that. I'm having a fight. Blah, blah. Oh, man. And then I get so bugged. I say, all right, forget about it. It's over. We're going to watch Star Wars or something like that. You know, but that's my failure. However, the times that I persevered, I find that it does smooth out a little bit and they kind of fall into place and we get a rhythm going. And the time limit, I think, is really a good one. Sometimes 30 minutes, even for some families, that might even be too much. But your point is that there is an end in view for the young people. They know when this is going to end. It's not going to be forever. I'll tell you the recommendation that I gave when I was asked this question at Facebook Live as I hung my head with dissatisfaction in my own performance here is I said two things that I would suggest, and maybe you can weigh in on this, is that you start early. In other words, get your kids used to the idea that this is something we do because we're a Christian family and this is part of our family life, and start early. Preschool. And so you're not trying to start when you got a rebellious teenager. That's one thing. Secondly, be consistent. Just be consistent. If it's every Wednesday night after dinner, then make it every Wednesday night after dinner, or however it happens to be, just make it consistent, because I think kids then will get into the habit of having this and they're less likely to push back on those occasions. What do you think about that?
Yeah, those are hugely important takeaways, I think. I mean, looking back, I think the most important thing that a parent of young kids can do, very young kids, is to establish that pattern in their life because that's what they come to expect. So absolutely, I agree with that. Something else that I have found that has really profoundly shaped the way that I'm doing things now is to remember that if you have more than one kid, and this doesn't apply if you have a single child, but if you have more than one kid, there are family dynamics that happen in terms of how those kids relate to one another on spiritual topics. And I, for a long time, saw our family as like a spiritual portfolio where I was looking at it in terms of, okay, overall, on average, are we kind of moving up together? We had a good conversation, you know? But in reality, I could look back and say, wow, we had a great conversation, but that was really only one of my kids having a great night interacting with us. And I'm not saying that's not beneficial for the other kids because they're processing it. And that can be a really good strategy too. If you have one that's uninterested and one that is, then they can still absorb what they're hearing. So that's a good thing. But at the same time, I think that we have to look at each kid and be mindful of their own spiritual development. So I have one in particular that just is not going to contribute in that kind of group setting. And I'm going in when I work with that child individually, we'll have much better conversations. Mm-hmm. And so I make sure to take the time that way. So I think it's wonderful and necessary to have family conversations. But I think that there are a lot of dynamics that happen with siblings that can affect how much each one is going to participate.
Right.
And I think that that's a really important thing for parents to be mindful of. And then finally, I would just add that, you know, if your kids aren't participating, yes, we should expect that there are ups and downs. But if it seems to be a deeper issue, then we need to understand, well, what is that issue? You know, if they don't want to be there because they want to go have fun, but yet they would, you know, fully consider themselves a Christian, that's one type of troubleshooting you do. Mm-hmm. If your child is not wanting to be there because they have a totally different worldview at this point that they're developing, I would switch gears on that and start asking, okay, well, you know, what is it that you believe now? You know, how have you come to that conclusion? Why do you have those beliefs, and start having some of those conversations. Okay, if you don't believe in God, let's start talking about the logical implications of an atheistic worldview.
Yeah.
And making sure they understand, okay, you're walking away from Christianity. What exactly are you walking toward?
What's the alternative? So,
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
right.
So it depends why they don't want to engage to some degree in terms of how to handle that.
When before we go to break, I'm just curious if there is a parent that wants to start this journey with you as a guide, which of your three books, if any in particular, would you suggest they start with?
Well, I think it just depends on what they have already learned. If you're looking for just an apologetics 101, like I've never learned anything about this stuff and I need kind of a broad overview, that would be my first book. But if you're working with kids who maybe are, you know, rejecting God altogether, maybe a teenager who's like, Mom, Dad, I don't believe in God, I'd go to Talking With Your Kids About God. And if you're looking for the nuts and bolts of Christianity specifically, why do we have good reason to believe Jesus was who he said he was and was raised from the dead, that would be the new book.
Yeah. And that new book is really the topic of our discussion today, Talking With Your Kids About Jesus, author Natasha Crane. More in a moment here on Stand to Reason. Stay with us. You know, if you've gained anything from listening to Stand to Reason, I'd really be thrilled to hear it from you. I love to take your questions, of course, but I also want your feedback. So here's what you can do. Head over to iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave us a rating and a review. That kind of thing really helps us to get the word out so more ambassadors for Christ can find the show and become equipped to stand confidently. And you never know, I might just give you a shout out on the air to show you my appreciation for your positive review. I value you as a faithful listener. I look forward to reading what you think about the show. Thanks.
Are you looking for a way to be more involved in the STR community? When you choose to support Stand to Reason with a monthly gift of $10 or more, you become a strategic partner in the work of equipping Christian ambassadors. Your monthly commitment makes you a part of a special group helping STR-trained Christians to graciously defend classical Christianity and classical Christian values. Your monthly gift helps us plan and manage STR's resources and provides consistent support to aid our planning and ongoing work. As a strategic partner, you'll enjoy an automatic 10% discount in our online store, access to a private Facebook group, and bi-monthly insider updates, so you'll get the inside scoop on what's going on in the ministry, and you'll know what you can pray for. Become a strategic partner in the Stand to Reason community today by visiting str.org/donate. Click How Often Will You Donate and choose Monthly. For personal assistance, you can email ocean@str.org. That's ocean@str.org.
Thank you, Derek. There he was. Johnny on the spot this time. Greg Kokel back with you here. Stand to Reason. My guest, Natasha Crane, author of Keeping Your Kids on God's Side, Talking With Your Kids About God, and Talking Now With Your Kids About Jesus, her third book, and publisher of the last two, Baker Bookhouse. Before we get into something new here, I don't want to miss an opportunity for you to say something about your blog, because it's really popular, ChristianMomThoughts.com. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, my blog is a place where I've basically over the years gone from just blogging about Christian parenting in general to getting attacked by skeptics on the blog, which led me to research answers and discover apologetics. And then I turned around and I started making my blog a place where I'm helping parents understand these issues and saying, hey, here's what the world is saying to your kids. Here's how we need to respond. And I used to write more directly about apologetics topics. Now I'm writing more about things related to the current events with those apologetics topics and worldview issues.
Yeah, I love this that, and I want people to keep this in mind, as Natasha's a mom. She's got kids. She's got a regular, ordinary life. You know, she does some public speaking and stuff, but her family's first. And that's the case for lots of families who want to have a spiritual impact. Lots of parents who want to have a spiritual impact in their families. And that's one of the reasons I think that, Natasha, your material is so good, because you approach it from the perspective of your situation in life. And that is as a thoughtful Christian mom. And that's why your blog is called Christian Mom Thoughts, and .com will get you there. Do you want to say anything about Gap?
Well, a couple of years ago, a team and I started something called Grassroots Apologetics for Parents. Short is GAP. And the whole idea is that there's a gap today between parents knowing that there is a challenge with our secular world and it's going to impact their kids' faith and knowing what to do about it. And so my passion personally as a writer and speaker is to close that gap. But we also have this team where we're working to start chapters across the country where we're looking for parent ambassadors, which is just a person in a local church who says, yes, I would like to lead meetings where we're doing these book studies and getting parents up to speed on these things. We lay out the whole process. You know, here's what you should study first and here's where you go next. And our hope is that over a 2-year time period that these chapters will have gone through 4 different studies and really learned the basics of apologetics from the God level questions to the Jesus level and the Bible level. So if you're interested in becoming a parent ambassador or looking for a chapter that might be near you, we have several dozen chapters already launched in multiple countries, actually. You can go to grassrootsapologeticsforparents.com.
Well, there's been kind of an explosive interest in what you offer with GAP, as I understand. I don't know, maybe things have slowed down a little bit, but certainly out of the gates, you had all kinds of interest, and that's a good sign.
Yeah, we've been so happy about it. Obviously, with COVID, it's a little bit different because people don't necessarily want to meet right away. But in the long term, we know that this is going to be a really beautiful thing to see so many chapters launching and really just getting parents and grandparents together to learn about these things. And we've heard great stories back from how people came into it a little bit skeptical, like, well, what exactly are we doing here, to saying, oh, wow, this is exactly what we needed and what our kids and grandkids
need. Sure. Yeah, great. Good for you. Now, we've got about 10 more minutes left, so I thought maybe what we do is just kind of hop, skip, and jump through your parts. There are 5 main parts of the book, which identify just different categories of studies with 4, 5, or 6 studies or conversations following the pattern you described earlier in each section. And maybe I'll just hit these sections one by one, and you can tell us a little bit about their importance and what you try to do there. Part one, understandably, is simply titled The Identity of Jesus. And you start out by talking about having read John Dominic Crossan a number of years ago without realizing what his project was, which was quite hostile to the historical Christianity. And why don't you mention something about that, and then how that led to some of the ideas that you developed there in part one, The Identity of Jesus.
Yeah, so I grew up in a Christian home and had been a lifelong Christian, but I was kind of a nominal Christian by the time that I went to college. And by the time that I graduated, I realized, you know, I really should understand my faith a little more deeply. And so I headed off to the local bookstore and looked for a quote-unquote Christian section, because certainly there could be nothing that's non-Christian there. And just kind of thumbed through the books and happened upon this book called Jesus, A Revolutionary Biography. And the subtitle was that it's a startling account about the life of Jesus. And I took it home and I read the book, and I was absolutely startled by what I had read, because the Jesus that he presented was just completely different than the Jesus that I had grown up hearing about. There were no miracles performed, and anything about a resurrection would have only been symbolic in nature. Just everything was completely different. And it took me a long time to really figure out what was going on there, and to learn that he was, you know, very representative of the skeptical type of scholarship from the Jesus Seminar that was formed back in 1985 to kind of figure out who was the historical Jesus, what can we trust in the Bible, basically, that's historical, that's different than the Jesus of faith. And it was very representative of that type of scholarship, but I just had no idea. I was blindsided by it. And if we can't establish for our kids what really is the identity of Jesus, how do we know that based on the Bible, and how can we believe what the Bible says about this rather than picking and choosing according to which acts and words we think are historical, we have no basis for the rest of the things I talk about in the book. And that's why the book starts there with the identity. Who cares about the teachings of Jesus if we can't be confident that he was who he claimed to be? Mm-hmm. If we can't establish his authority as the creator and the sustainer of the universe, then we don't need to care what he taught. Mm-hmm. So this first section is so important from that perspective, that kids just have this really deep grounding and understanding that Jesus existed and that he was the Messiah. Messiah and a Jewish Messiah, and that he, in fact, claimed to be God, and that there's evidence that he was God and performed these miracles. And so mm-hmm. I walk through these questions for parents in that first section.
And this is the Jesus that we're defending, and we're getting the information from the primary source historical documents that people like John Dominic Crossan were working with, without bringing in all these biases saying, well, we don't believe this, that, and the other thing because it doesn't fit our materialistic worldview, essentially. So, okay, good. Part one, the identity of Jesus. Part two, the teachings of Jesus. What are you trying to accomplish in this section?
Well, I could have talked about a whole lot of things when we say the teachings of Jesus, because there's a lot that can be covered there. But with six chapters to talk about this, I wanted to focus on the things that popularly come up so often that both skeptics and Christians misunderstand. And so keeping in with this theme of challenges that kids will encounter, it's important to know that kids are going to encounter challenges in their understanding of Christianity from fellow Christians, from people who identify themselves as Christians, but have some very biblical misunderstandings. And so that section covers questions like, what did Jesus teach about judging others? You know, you can't go anywhere online and say anything about what the Bible said without someone saying, hey, you're judging me, right? And the same with, what did Jesus teach about loving others? Even with love, it sounds like, oh, hey, that's an easy one. We should all be able to agree on what it means to love others. But in reality, we don't agree on what it means to love others. And our kids need to understand, well, why is that the case? And I also talk about things like, what did Jesus teach about hell? And did Jesus really teach these the only way to God? These are some of the big questions that are so often misunderstood today. And so we really just get back in those chapters to, what did Jesus say exactly?
And those are really big targets, not just from critics on the outside, but also from critics on the inside. And this is one of the things that it's good for parents to be aware of, that, hey, doubt is kind of a natural thing. Everybody doubts sooner or later, even Christians who are very confident in their convictions and have good reasons. Everybody doubts. It's part of the human condition. However, the seeds of doubt are not just coming from the outside with atheists and skeptics, etc. Now, the seeds of doubt are being planted from the inside by Christians, allegedly part of, especially of the new movement, progressive Christianity, and all of these things. Is Jesus the only way? Is he God? Was he born of a virgin? Blood atonement, all of these kinds of things, the teachings of Jesus, these are all under attack inside the church, not just outside. So that's really important to be grounded in this. Part three is the death of Jesus. I made reference to it a moment ago. So what's at stake here, the death of Jesus?
So this is where I dig in, like I was talking about earlier, to this statement, Jesus died for my sins. And in fact, in the introduction to that section, I even give one of the keys as to this section as, hey, make sure your kids understand that even if they think they know all this stuff already, when they hear that you're going to be talking about the death of Jesus, make sure you say, hey, there's much more that we can understand. There's much more depth to it, just to warn them, because a lot of times kids will just tune you out and say, I already know about this stuff, right?
I got it.
So, right. So with the death of Jesus, I talk about things like, you know, what about the Old Testament sacrifices? What exactly does that mean? And did Jesus die willingly for us? What did Jesus' death on the cross accomplish? You know, that's something that today, a lot of times Christians, especially progressive Christians, will say, well, that's very subjective. You know, here's what it means to me. But the Bible's very clear that there are some very objective things that Jesus accomplished on the cross for all people. So I tackle these kinds of questions to just really help parents take their kids into a deeper understanding of that whole idea, that whole just critical truth for us that Jesus died for our sins.
And you mentioned a little earlier the phrase, the cosmic child abuse, that some people level against the substitutionary view that Jesus died for our sins. He paid for us. Do you deal with that challenge in that chapter at all? I mean, it's the idea that God abuses his child on our behalf.
Right. So I talk about that in the chapter on Did Jesus Die Willingly? And I talk about it in terms of three P's that our kids can remember, that Jesus' death was planned, it was purposeful, and it was personal. And so I kind of just walk through those three points of showing that Jesus said that he must suffer and die. This was part of a plan. This wasn't something he didn't accidentally end up in the wrong hands, and that it was purposeful. He knew why he was going to die, that he was going to die for the sins of many, and that finally it was personal that he chose to lay down his life for us. And of course, the big point that Jesus being God himself, if you have an appropriate understanding of theology, Jesus laid down his life by his own choice, being God himself. So this is not a third party kind of victim. Jesus himself was God making the decision. So that's in the chapter on whether or not Jesus died willingly.
And again, those are the kinds of things that will really serve ordinary Christians, adult Christians, well when these kinds of challenges are leveled. Now, in part four, you talk about the resurrection of Jesus, and you actually go into some more issues that are a little bit more complex. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I start this section by talking about why does it matter if Jesus was resurrected, and I think this is something that apologetics books typically skip over way too fast. You know, a lot of times it goes straight to the evidence. You know, here's how we know Jesus was raised from the dead, and here are theories and all this stuff. But I think kids first have to understand that this matters because if Jesus was not raised from the dead, then our faith is in vain, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians. And so that chapter really just walks parents through an understanding of why this question matters so much. And then I go through the historical facts surrounding this, the minimal facts, as many people who are listening to this, I'm sure have heard. And then just laying out in the chapters the basic questions like, did the disciples lie about this? And I talk about whether or not they were capable of lying, given what we know. And were they mistaken? And I talk about medical hallucination theories and why that just totally fails. And how do we know that the tomb was empty? Another big question. And how do we know that this wasn't just a legend? I think this is the most common objection that I hear just, you know, out on the internet is, well, I'm sure it was just made up later. Well, that sounds pretty reasonable to a lot of people. But when you actually go back and you look at the documents and you look at how closely you can trace them back to the time of Jesus, you realize this could not have been something that grew into a legend over time. There wasn't enough time. And even many atheist scholars recognize that we can see that this was an early, early belief in the church that Jesus was, in fact, raised from the dead. Of course, they're not always saying, yes, that actually happened, but they're saying this was the claim of the early church. It wasn't something that was invented 100 years later.
That's right.
And these are things that kids can understand. I think that sometimes parents might hear that and say, well, how can I possibly have my kids get something like that? But I talk about it from that perspective in each of the chapters to show, okay, here's how you would do this.
Mm-hmm. Well, you do it so well. Part five is the difference that Jesus makes, and we've talked about that a little bit already, and we got about 30 seconds left in the show. I just want my audience to know that Natasha is a very good writer, and you could tell just by her speaking, she's very clear, to the point, well-organized, and the same thing in her writing, very winsome and attractive style. You will not have any trouble following what Natasha has to say, because she is clear, and she is also engaging in her style. Good work, Natasha.
And thank you so much.
I was going to ask you if you got anything else going, but probably the last thing a person who just gets a book out like 3 weeks ago wants to think about is starting another one. So we'll make that a different conversation. But thanks so much for joining us here on Stand to Reason.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Natasha Crane, a latest book, Talking with Your Kids About Jesus, but all the rest of them really, really useful as well. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. You give them heaven this week. Bye-bye now.